This is the Robert Greenstein teleconference for Center on Budget and Policy for Monday, April 23rd, 2012 at 3 p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speaker in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is currently in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. I would now like to turn the conference over to Robert Greenstein.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I have with me here Paul Vandewater, whom a number of you know, senior fellow with the Center, former assistant director of CBO, senior Social Security Administration official, vice president for health policy at the National Academy of Social Insurance, and a leading expert on both Social Security and Medicare. I'm going to have some short remarks about Social Security and today's trustees report, and then turn it over to Paul, who will supplement those remarks and cover Medicare. I should also note that the center, we are in the very final stages of completing short analyses in the form of statements on both the Social Security report and the Medicare report. I would imagine both of those will be posted while we are conducting this call. In the area of Social Security, I think what we learned today in the trustees' report could be described as a source for concern, but not panic. The trustees project the exhaustion date for Social Security trust funds as being 2033. That is 3 years earlier than the 2036 date they projected last year. But it is in the range that the trustees have predicted over the last two decades. Over the last two decades, the trustees have predicted the exhaustion date ranging anywhere from 2029 to 2042. The date goes up and down depending on changes in the economy, the latest demographic forecasts, and the like. And what the 2033 figure issued today means is that the trustees' current projection is that the Social Security trust funds can pay 100% of promised benefits to 2033, but not beyond that. Now, that does not mean that the program goes bankrupt in 2033 and can't pay anything after that. Each year when the trustees' report comes out, many Americans mistakenly assume hearing headlines or sometimes pundits misstating what the trustees' report means. I think many Americans mistakenly assume that after the date this year, it's 2033, that there's absolutely nothing there at all. What the trustees project is that after 2033, if nothing is done, Social Security will be able to pay 75% of scheduled benefits rather than 100%. Obviously, that shouldn't be acceptable, but it should be correctly understood. The other most notable item regarding Social Security in today's report is the projection that the Disability Insurance Trust Fund, Social Security Disability, will become insolvent in 2016. Now, there are two key points to recognize there. The first is that in the past, on occasions when one of the two Social Security trust funds has been scheduled to become insolvent at a date significantly earlier than the other, it has been standard practice to reallocate money between the two trust funds so that they go insolvent at the same time about. And the 2033 figure that I have been mentioning essentially assumes that such a reallocation will occur. It is the date that both trust funds would go insolvent upon if the revenues were shared between them in such a way that they both continued to pay full benefits until the same date and then were unable to pay full benefits after that date. But the second key point about disability insurance is the more important one. And that is that it would be a very major mistake for policymakers to look at these date differentials and to try to address Social Security disability insurance on its own in the absence of broader changes to Social Security as a whole. That's because the revenue base, cost of living adjustments, and most important of all, the essential Social Security benefit formula are similar or identical for disability insurance and Social Security retirement benefits and survivor benefits, and there are fundamental interactions in the basic benefit structure between the disability benefits and the retirement benefits and how people move from disability to retirement benefits upon reaching certain ages. The result is that trying to tackle disability insurance in isolation would give policymakers very few options. The options would be relatively harsh, and you would probably get serious and sometimes bizarre side effects because of the key interactions between the two programs. So that leads to the logical conclusion, and the logical conclusion is that policymakers should comprehensively address Social Security as a whole, and given the findings in today's report, should do it sooner rather than later. With that, let me turn it over to Paul Vandervoort.
Thanks, Bob. I'll focus on the Medicare trustees report, and we'll leave any further issues you may want to raise about Social Security until the question and answer time. In Medicare, there's no change in the headline date, that is, the protected date of insolvency of the hospital insurance trust fund. That was projected to be 2024 last year, and it remains 2024 in this year's report. I'll emphasize with regard to hospital insurance, the situation, the issue of insolvency is exactly the same as Bob stated for the Disability Insurance Trust Fund. Insolvency does not mean that the program, that the hospital insurance program is bankrupt, that it will run out of money. In fact, in the year of insolvency, 2024, the income coming in will still be sufficient to cover something around 90%, perhaps more, of the program's outlays. So the problem is significant but manageable. The longer-run situation in the trustees project is slightly less favorable than in last year's report, exclusively because the trustees adopted a whole lot of small changes in technical assumptions that were recommended by the recent Medicare technical advisory panel. The most important thing to note is that these changes in technical assumptions have nothing to do with the assumptions about the effectiveness of health reform, the Affordable Care Act. These changes are all quite independent of that and have to do with assumptions about what the underlying rate of growth of health care costs would be prior to the enactment of health reform. As far as health reform is concerned, the trustees are very explicit. In their summary report, they say, once again, projected Medicare costs over 75 years are substantially lower than they otherwise would be because of provisions in health reform. The importance of implementing health reform, as well as, I'd say, paying for any changes in the physician payment updates, is emphasized in the alternative projections that the trustees provide. As you know, for the past couple of years, Rick Foster, the Medicare actuary, has been raising questions about whether or not it will be possible to implement fully all of the payment reductions that are provided for in the ACA, and the trustees for the past 2 years have shown an alternative scenario that assumes that those reductions are not fully implemented. This year, the trustees actually provide two different scenarios, one that assumes that the physician payment reductions required by the sustainable growth rate formula, the so-called SGR, do not go into effect and are not paid for, and the second projection that assumes that the SGR changes don't go into effect, as well as assuming that not all of the health reform savings go into effect either. Those changes are those two alternative scenarios are illustrated in a graph very early on in the Medicare report, and they emphasize quite clearly two things. One, why any changes to the physician payment formula should be paid for, as I might say they actually have been in the past few years. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, MedPAC, the Congress's nonpartisan advisory body, in its March report last month, presented a whole list of options that the Congress could use for paying for a permanent fix to the SGR formula. And then secondly, of course, the alternative projections also illustrate once again the importance of implementing, insofar as possible, all of the changes in the Affordable Care Act, including the growth rate limitation, which is supposed to be enforced by the Independent Payment Advisory Board. The House of Representatives recently voted to repeal IPAB, but the alternative projection here in the trustees' report illustrates the importance of retaining IPAB as a fallback mechanism to slow the rate of growth of health care costs. So, bottom line, there's no change in the projected insolvency of HI, some modest changes affecting the long-run projections, and a continued illustration of the need to pay for fixing the sustainable growth rate formula and for implementing fully the changes in health reform.